At a time when women were not allowed to participate in politics or war, when even their opinions were discouraged, a certain resolute female patriot rose out of obscurity and fought valiantly in the American War for Independence. She asserted herself, but not in combat on a battlefield, nor in the great halls of Congress. She wasn't heard at vast assemblies delivering inspired speeches. Her weapon, like other bold patriots at the time, was her persuasive pen. Mercy was born the third child of 13 into a fairly affluent family in 1728. Her mother, Mary Alin Otis, was a descendant of a Mayflower passenger. Of Mary's 13 children, only 7 lived to adulthood. Mercy's father, James Otis Sr., had many jobs throughout his life, including farmer, attorney, colonel in the local militia, and judge in Barnstable, Massachusetts, where they lived. When Mercy was a teen, her father was elected to the Massachusetts House of Representatives. She watched him serve as an outspoken rival to the British governor of their colony, Thomas Hutchinson. Mercy Otis Warren set herself apart early on with a hunger for learning and a voracious appetite for reading. Her father supported her deep desire for an education, a very uncommon paternal act in the 18th century, and allowed her to be tutored alongside her two older brothers by their uncle, Reverend John Russell. He taught Mercy to write and was a poignant influence with his rousing use of words and voice in his Sunday sermons. Although she was not permitted to learn Greek and Latin or to attend college like her brothers, she read books on many diverse subjects, such as history, politics, and literature. All of this reading must be chiefly credited for her elegance of speech. Steeped in politics from an early age, Mercy's intellect and interest in the political realm was encouraged by the men in her life, including her father, James Otis Sr., her brother, James Otis Jr., who went by Jemmy, and her husband, James Warren. Mercy was content, however, with her life as a typical 18th century woman, which consisted of marriage, raising 5 sons, working the farm, churning butter, shearing sheep, and combing the wool, which she then spun into thread, wove into cloth, and used to sew her family's clothing. How she had time to write is mystifying, but she managed to compose poetry and letters to friends amidst her many responsibilities at home. Numerous letters were written between Mercy and her husband James that reflected their long, loving relationship. James' political career kept him in Boston, 38 miles from Plymouth, where Mercy managed home and farm. They lived apart from 1766 until 1781. On occasion, Mercy would travel the distance to Boston on horseback to spend some time with her husband. "I again tell you that on your happiness depends mine," James wrote to his wife of 9 years. After 20 years of marriage, he penned, "No husband ever loved and respected a wife more." Her letters to James were filled with equally tender lines, calling him the dear companion of my life and first friend of my heart. At the onset of the Revolution in 1775, she wrote, "My little heart is more affected with what gives pain or endangers you than with anything else." James quickly realized that Mercy had a talent for writing and encouraged her to write down her convictions. He gave her the nickname the Scribbler and supported everything she wrote. Mercy and James hosted dinners in their home to support the cause of freedom, including for the Sons of Liberty, who fought against the Stamp Act of 1765. Among them were Samuel Adams, John Hancock, Paul Revere, and Mercy's brother, Jemmy Otis. Throughout the years, they hosted many dinners wherein impassioned patriots deliberated and shared thoughts, ideas, and plans to free colonists from Britain's contemptible burdens. Of all her siblings, Mercy was closest to Jemmy, admiring him for his work in rebuffing the oppressive British. A Harvard graduate, Jemmy became a prestigious Boston attorney. His fiery five-hour oration in the Superior Court, arguing against the British writs of assistance, which allowed British soldiers to enter and inspect homes and businesses without a warrant, stimulated the Revolutionary Crusade in 1761. John Adams later recalled, "Otis was a flame of fire. I have never known a man whose love of country was more ardent or sincere. Never one who suffered so much. Never one whose service for any 10 years of his life were so important and essential to the cause of his country as those of Mr. Otis from 1760 to 1770. Unfortunately, Jemmy Otis began to suffer from mental illness. He would go from one moment of calm, rational discussion to a sudden raging menace of rambling nonsense. It was said that only Mercy's voice had the power to calm him when all else was without effect. In 1772, he was sent to live with friends and family in the country where he could recover and be spared further public embarrassment. Mercy, determined to keep Jemmy's patriotic fervor alive, picked up her pen in his place. From the quaint farmhouse in Plymouth, the slightly built mother of five scrawled out the smoldering words fanned by the winds of change that became a sweeping fire across the colonies. The Adulator, written in blank verse poetry, was published anonymously in 1772. As it would be considered an act of treason against the British crown, only Mercy's closest friends knew she had authored it. The satirical play jeered at the policies of the British loyalist governor of Massachusetts, Thomas Hutchinson. The play was so well received by the public that locals began to refer to Hutchinson as Rapatio, the foolish antagonist of the script. The Adulator actually predicted the Revolutionary War and the happy triumph of the colonists. It created a hunger for liberation and served as a catalyst to get people talking, thinking, and doing. Mercy published another play the following year, entitled The Defeat, which depicted the diabolical Rapatio bribing loyalist followers while scheming to crush the patriots. Rapatio is destroyed in the end. Again, the play was published anonymously but was widely read and discussed. For the 4 years leading up to the Declaration of Independence, Mercy continued to criticize the Loyalist governor's policies. The Scribbler penned some of the American Revolutionary era's most searing accusations of British violations of colonial freedom. That same year, 1773, John Adams came back into the scene of politics, having 18 months earlier given up civic duty to farm his land in Braintree. However, as he said, "Peculiar obligations to undeceive the people changed my resolution." It didn't take long for the Adamses and the Warrens to become close friends. Mercy and Abigail exchanged letters for most of the rest of their lives. Mercy and James both exchanged letters with John, who became an ardent supporter of Mercy and her brilliant pen. Surprising as it may be, Mercy struggled with insecurities about her writing and leaned on the encouragement of mentors like John Adams to quell her anxieties and soldier on, cutting down enemy lines with the genius of her words. John Adams wrote the following to James: "Tell your wife that God Almighty has entrusted her with the powers for the good of the world, which, in the cause of his providence, he bestows on few of the human race. That instead of being a fault to use them, it would be criminal to neglect them." After the Boston Tea Party at the end of 1773, John Adams, declaring the event to be an epoch in history, asked Mercy to write a satirical poem to memorialize the event. She produced a whimsical poem called "The Squabble of the Sea Nymphs." John described the poem as one of the incontestable evidences of real genius and had it published in the Boston Gazette. Mercy wrote another explosive satirical play, "The Group," published in January 1775, lampooning real-life characters with fictitious names. How scrupulously informed she must have been to have written so deftly a piece that accurately characterized the shrewd people and events of the day. John Adams praised her as an incomparable satirist. He wrote, "Of all the geniuses which have yet arisen in America, there has been none superior to one which now shines in this happy, this exquisite faculty. I know of none, ancient or modern, which has reached the tender, the pathetic, the keen and severe, and at the same time the soft, the sweet, the amiable, and the pure in great perfection." The play prophetically predicted a bloody conflict between patriots and the British on a field of green in April, the colonies proving victorious. It turned out to be a foretelling of the Battle of Lexington and Concord, occurring a few months later, indeed on April 19, 1775. During the Revolutionary War, colonists boycotted British goods, which was a cause taken on primarily by the women, as they were the main consumers of goods used in the home. Rather than purchase lavish silks and elegant linens from Europe, women were encouraged to make their own clothing from homespun wool and cotton. The price of wheat, corn, and other necessities soared, creating grim conditions for famished colonists. Bostonians received no foreign trade due to the British blockade of the Boston Harbor. They lived mainly on cod, beans, and salt-cured meat. Smallpox and other diseases ravaged the colonies, and Boston was no exception. Two-thirds of its citizens had fled to the country. Mercy remained in Plymouth with four of her sons still at home. Amidst her duties as a mother and wife, she kept John Adams abreast of the happenings of Massachusetts, particularly Boston, while he served in Philadelphia. By the end of 1775, Mercy felt drawn to write a history of the events swirling around her. Over the next 30 years, she devoted herself to this task. With the publishing of her work in 1805, she became the first woman to write a history of the American Revolution. I hope we learn here, my young friends, that when we feel a pull to do something good, difficult as it may be, we do it despite the obstacles, which may be many. In Mercy's case, her insecurities, the insurmountable mountain of information to gather, the long expanse of time, and the exceedingly arduous task of writing it all into an accurate history was a nearly impossible task. Her three-volume History of the Rise, Progress, and Termination of the American Revolution covered 25 years of events, beginning with the Stamp Act to the ratification of the Constitution. President Jefferson was so impressed with her work that he ordered advanced copies for himself and his staff. The book quickly grew in popularity. In the meantime, Mercy's dearest sibling, Jemmy, was doing better in the country, living with family and friends and teaching school. In the spring of 1783, he stood on the porch of a friend, relishing the spectacle of a lightning and thunderstorm as he leaned on his father's silver-topped cane. With no warning, James the Patriot was suddenly struck with a bolt of lightning. He died instantly at the age of 58. Mercy was shocked, especially remembering what Jemmy had once told her. "My dear sister, I hope when God Almighty in His righteous providence shall take me out of time into eternity, that it will be by a flash of lightning." Mercy and James experienced further heartbreak the following year when their third son, 23-year-old Charles, died of tuberculosis while living in Spain. They did not find out until several weeks after the fact. Though she deeply mourned his passing, Mercy felt an expressive calmness for Charles. She wrote, "He has done his work. He has entered before us to bid welcome to the eternal shores those he so tenderly loved." What may be surprising about a staunch patriot such as Mercy is that she opposed the newly written Constitution. She believed it gave too much power to a central government. In 1788, she published an anti-federalist booklet with her opinions and view on why the Constitution should not be ratified. This put her and James somewhat at odds with the Adamses and other notable patriots of the time. Her booklet argued for greater rights for the people. The Bill of Rights, which was passed in 1791, was considered a victory for Mercy and other anti-federalists, who then put all of their influence behind the ratification of the Constitution. The accomplished author that she was, Mercy had never published a work under her own name. Finally, in 1790, a book of poems and plays was published in hardcover, Poems, Dramatic and Miscellaneous, written by Mrs. M. Warren. The message of the book was that tyranny and strife for the sake of power could ultimately cause the destruction of a nation or empire. She dedicated the book to George Washington, who responded, "From the reputation of the author, from the parts I have read, and from a general idea of the pieces, I am persuaded of its gracious and distinguished reception by the friends of virtue and science." Mercy endured much suffering over the next decade when two more sons passed away. Winslow was killed as a soldier in New York in 1791, and in 1800 her youngest son George died of illness at 33 years old. "The waves have rolled upon me," Mercy penned. "The billows are repeatedly broken over me. Yet I am not struck down. Shall I complain that I have never been suffered to catch the last accents of my dying friends and children? No." Then, quoting Psalm 103, verse 14, in an expression of faith, she wrote, "He who knoweth my frame knoweth what is fittest for me." When Mercy's history was published in 1805, it caused a deep rift between her and John Adams. He disagreed with how she portrayed him in her history. The longtime friends stopped writing for several years. Her friendship with Abigail resumed in 1812, each forgiving the other for past disagreements. They talked about all the events that had passed wherein their pens to one another had been silent, including the passing of Mercy's husband in 1808. John Adams finally softened and wrote Mercy in 1813, rekindling a long, silent friendship. Abigail used a lock of hair Mercy had given her and made a ring with Mercy's, John's, and Abigail's hair woven together. Mercy wore and treasured it. On October 19, 1814, Mercy Otis Warren passed away quietly in her bed. "She expired with great calmness and perfect recollection of mind," reported her son Henry. Her coffin was carried up to Burial Hill of the Pilgrims, where some of the Plymouth Pilgrims and Mercy's husband had been buried. A 19th century biographer of early American women, Mrs. Ellett, said, "In point of influence, Mercy Warren was the most remarkable woman who lived in the days of the American Revolution. Seldom has one woman in any age acquired such an ascendancy over the strongest by the mere force of a powerful intellect." I have left for you a pen. In honor of Mrs. Mercy Otis Warren, may you ever remember its power and not use it lightly. If moved upon to lift a friend, to scrawl out your heart's delight, or to pen a play that spurs the public mind and breeds some needed action, pick up your pen, my dear ones. Shy not away from the call to write, as the soldier shrinks not from the battle. For bad or for good, for a small change of heart, or for a revolution, never underestimate the power of the pen.